Welcome to the Rurik Primary Review, where we cover the latest developments in high yield, distressed debt, and bankruptcy, and feature discussions on issues affecting distressed debt, leveraged finance, direct lending, high yield bonds, high yield municipals, covenants, private credit, and middle market companies. I'm David Zupkis. This week, Seth Brumby, Deputy Managing Editor at Rurik, and Michelle Handy, Senior Managing Director at First Eagle and Chief Investment Officer for its direct lending business, talk about recent trends in M&A volume, how recent declines in total enterprise value has impacted deal flow, the shifting dynamic between private credit and broadly syndicated loans across different market segments, and much more. And as always, we bring you our weekly summary of interesting developments in the restructuring world, as well as a preview of what's on tap for next week. It's Monday, April 22nd.
Hello, everyone. My name is Seth Brumby, Deputy Managing Editor at Rurik, and I'm with you again for the second consecutive week on the Primary View. It's my pleasure to do so. This week, we're switching markets and heading over to private credit, middle market, and direct lending. Joining me today is Michelle Handy, Senior Managing Director at First Eagle. She's also the Chief Investment Officer of the direct lending business, and she's the perfect person to weigh in on the first quarter of this year and how trends look for LBOs and other M&A activity. I know that we've seen a little bit of an improvement year over year, but that's a low bar that we're starting from. But we're still below pre-pandemic volumes, and I wanted to get a sense from Michelle, what are the factors leading to an improved market, and what do we need to see in order for it to open up?
Well, good morning, Seth. Thanks for having me this morning. Yeah, so there's been two primary drivers that have been really driving M&A volumes being relatively muted over the last 12 to 24 months. The first is pretty obvious. It's the higher interest rate environment. There's a higher correlation to lower deal-making activity when there's higher interest rates. So that's the one sort of first primary factor. And the second really is the decline in transaction enterprise values or enterprise value multiples. What we've seen in the data is about a 1.5 to 2 turns in enterprise value multiple decline over the last plus or minus 8 quarters, you know, really peaking out in Q4 of 21. Buyers and sellers need to be on the same page with respect to value in order to transact, and in a declining valuation environment really makes that a bit more difficult. So what's changed in Q1 is really sort of that initial outlook provided by the Fed that, you know, interest rates, the base rate was at least, you know, going to plateau in the second half of last year, and with the potential of interest rate step downs in 2024. And what we think we've seen in some of the initial data in Q1 is an increase in LBO refinance or amend and extend, reprice, and maybe even a little bit of recap activity as a result of some of the more stabilizing news that we've heard from the Fed last year.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the decline in enterprise value multiples, because I've wondered how much of a correlation, or if it's just coincident, that you see that decline in enterprise value multiples at the same time that you've seen an increase in interest rates. Is there some kind of direct correlation or causation there between the increased interest rates and the decline in enterprise values? Because I would think that the fundamentals of the underlying businesses are pretty strong right now.
Yeah, so I think there's probably two factors that have played into the decline in enterprise value. And when I say enterprise value, I mean transaction enterprise value. First is, because there's been lower deal activity, it's probable that the quality isn't entirely consistent with normalized M&A volumes. So you may have some skewing of enterprise value as a result of just the data set of deals that are actually closing, so maybe less quality within those transactions. The second piece of it is interest rates, right? If a buyer or a seller doesn't think that they're going to get top dollar and buyer can't get the appropriate financing, that ultimately impacts enterprise value. So there's really those two drivers that we think are impacting what we're seeing in the market.
Okay. And with those deals that are able to get done, what do we see deal structures like in the first quarter of this year? And how is it different than last year and maybe even pre-pandemic too?
Yeah, and maybe I'll split it up into a couple of different markets. Generally speaking, in the core middle market, there hasn't been a ton of change in structure and equity checks. Capital structures have tended to be more conservative generally speaking, given the size of company you're dealing with, so lower leverage, which infers a higher equity check. So changes in that market have been relatively modest over the last, 12 to 24 months. With lower M&A volumes in the BSL market, that's where you're really seeing the more pronounced shift. You're seeing the elevated interest rate environment forcing lower leverage levels, larger checks. And so you're seeing the more impactful impact on that BSL market.
Okay. With these lower volumes, what do you see in terms of deal structure and types of deals? And I guess I speak here of, your traditional cash flow financing versus ABL financing. Is there a market right now that prefers one or the other? And I'm sorry, Michelle, before you answer that, just for our audience to understand the difference between cash flow and ABL, I think it'd be a good way to set up your answer.
Yeah, sure. So the cash flow market is really a market in which you're lending on and relying on the cash flows generated by the business, as well as the enterprise value of the business to repay the loan or to service debt. So that's sort of the basics of the cash flow loan or market. From an ABL perspective, depending on the assets of the company. So those assets might be receivables, inventory, M&E, real estate, or less traditional or tangible assets such as intellectual property. And in that market, we work with third-party appraisal firms that help us to understand the value of the collateral, and then we lend on those assets in a borrowing base and based on a formula. So your underwriting doesn't rely on the cash flow generation of the business. You're really looking to the liquidity or the liquidation value of those assets to repay the loan. As a result, companies that are more asset rich tend to move towards ABL financing. So the cash flow in the ABL market can actually be a little bit of a countercyclical market. Typically, when the economy is less strong, cash flow market declines, ABL market picks up, and then vice versa. So we've seen a lot of ABL volume over the last 12 to 18 months. We continue to see that ABL volume, but we are starting to see the cash flow market start to come back.
Okay. And the cash flow model, I guess, would be that type of structure that you would see with more LBO and M&A type financing.
Correct. That is typically the case. You do every once in a while see ABLs in the LBO world to the extent the company is asset rich. It wouldn't be the only type of financing. It would be in conjunction with some type of cash flow financing, whether that be a first lien cash flow term loan, a second lien, or even mezz. But traditionally, the cash flow market has been the bulk of the LBO market.
Okay. And I guess if we were to see a pickup in cash flow, that would be an indicator that the LBO market is starting to improve too. And maybe with that, some private equity realizations of their vintage portfolios.
Absolutely.
Okay. Just very quickly, a theme that we've noticed probably over the past 3 to 6 months on the editorial desk here at Reorg is the competitive pressure between traditional banks and non-bank financial companies like a First Eagle. Can you break that down? And maybe does that kind of tension exist in the middle market, or do you feel that you guys are a little more insulated from that?
So generally speaking, we're a little bit more insulated from that in the middle market, but maybe I can take a step back and just a little bit of background. So coming out of the 2008 recession, regulatory changes really pushed banks to do two things. One is lessen their overall exposure to companies, right? Individual companies, as well as the second piece of it is skew exposure to larger corporate credits. So those were the two primary impacts. So as a result, the middle market hasn't seen a ton of competition from the banks, generally speaking, in more recent years, as a result of sort of the push towards larger corporate credits. Every once in a while, you might see a bank in the mix, given it's, a relatively lower levered credit. But for the most part, our competition really tends to be, the private credit direct lenders. In the upper middle market and the BSL market, that dynamic is very different. We've started to see private credit markets start to take share from the BSL market through COVID. And since then, we've seen that tension, the push-pull between the BSL and the direct lending market in sort of the larger finance world. While the BSL market was shut down or was experiencing volatility, the direct lenders stepped in to take share, offering, larger capital commitments as well as strategic execution. But with the more recent reopening of the BSL market and the supply-demand imbalance that we're seeing in that market, i.e. too much demand and not enough supply, share is really being taken back by that BSL market. And so what we've seen in Q1 of 24 is as interest rates have plateaued, deal activity has increased, primarily driven at this point by, you know, pricing, repricings and amend and extends, and lenders chasing quality has really started to compress spreads. So as a result, that BSL market has become more attractive and has taken share back from, you know, the direct lending or the private credit market because there's just better execution there right now.
Okay. You know, those are some great themes that you just touched on. And one other one that we've been following is the discussion between private equity and private credit firms and their LPs. There was some concern that the realization, at least from the private equity space, had been slower than I think a lot of those managers would have liked. Do you think with the current environment where we have seen a plateau of interest rates, pretty strong fundamentals too, how do you think that dialogue has evolved and what are the conversations like that you're having with your own LPs right now?
Yeah, I think, of course, LPs or investors want to see capital invested and returned on sort of more regular cycles, but they also want capital to be invested in quality credit. So what we've experienced is that our LPs have been very patient. What we've experienced is that the vintage of portfolios that are pre-COVID or just after COVID, those investment periods have elongated, really impacted by sponsors wanting to make sure that their investment thesis has an opportunity to play out because they've been disrupted by either, you know, a COVID impact or by generally high interest rate environments. So, you know, LPs are going to expect deployment and therefore return of capital, but I really think that they're going to be patient over the next 12 months.
Okay. And then reaching back to the earlier part of the conversation when we discussed how the rate environment can affect EV multiples. So even though you might have a really strong business, those EV multiples have declined. And does that make the realization for those vintages that much harder to accomplish?
Yeah, I think the decline in EV multiples is one factor. I think selling in a higher interest rate environment, because interest rates are higher, you know, financing packages may not be as attractive. And so that also impacts enterprise value. And so, yes, it all sort of is tied in together.
Okay. And I guess as we conclude our conversation, what's your outlook for the rest of the year? Do you see these conditions improving and therefore deal volume improving as well?
Yeah, I mean, we believe that a stabilized, declining, or, you know, reduced interest rate environment might encourage alignment on valuation, leading to deal-making activity. And as I mentioned earlier, there's already been some positive movements on that front with the Fed signaling a rate plateau and potential reductions in 24. And we think that those initial signals have already resulted in some increased deal activity in Q1. And without knowing for certain that a reduction will occur, we can't plan for that. We do think that there will likely be a step down this year, which will really drive an increase in activity in the back half of 24.
Okay. Well, Michelle, thank you so much. It's always insightful catching up with you. And I wish you the best of luck for the rest of the year.
Thank you.
For in-court coverage this week, we take a look at Jane Street Group, Diamond Sports Group, Wesco Aircraft, Aldrich Pump, and Genesis Global. Also, the latest developments in the Judge David R. Jones scandal out of the bankruptcy court for the Southern District of Texas. On April 12th, Jane Street Capital sued Millennium Management and two former Jane Street employees for allegedly stealing a highly valuable and counterintuitive trading strategy. Jane Street accuses Millennium of luring the employees to the firm to avoid the risk, time, and expense of independently developing its own successful trading strategy. The defendants, however, have called the suit a thinly veiled bid to create a non-compete where none exists, to keep a competitor out of the well-established, highly publicized index options market. At a hearing last Friday, Judge Paul Engelmeyer of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York denied Jane Street's motion for a temporary restraining order that would have barred the former employees from using the allegedly proprietary trading strategy. Last Wednesday, Judge Christopher Lopez approved the Diamond Sports Group debtor's revised disclosure statement for a solicitation, setting the planned confirmation hearing for June 18th. The NBA and NHL did not object, but filed statements expressing concern about the debtor's progress negotiating long-term broadcasting deals with their league and club partners and long-term carriage agreements with two major distributors, Comcast and DirecTV. At an uncontested hearing last Monday, Judge Marvin Isger approved the Wesco and Cora debtor disclosure statement supplement, which includes updated financial projections and a revised enterprise valuation for circulating to voting creditors. Judge Isger also extended the mediation with Judge Christopher Lopez until further order or declaration of impasse from the mediator. The confirmation hearing is scheduled to begin on May 16th. Counsel for the debtors, participating note holders, Silver Point and PIMCO, and the 2024-2026 formerly secured note holders told Judge Isgood that they still have hope for a mediated settlement of litigation over the company's March 2022 up-tier exchange. REWORK Legal and its team continues its coverage of the trial on the 2024-2026 formerly secured note holders' challenges to the up-tier. The trial, which has spanned 24 days, will resume on May 1st. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit rejected asbestos claimants' request for the court to directly review a key bankruptcy court decision denying dismissal of the Aldridge Pump Murray Boiler Texas 2-step cases. The appellate court's order issued last Wednesday indicated that the two judges on a three-judge panel voted to deny the petitions, while one judge voted in favor of direct review. If the Fourth Circuit had granted the petitions for a direct review, the appeals of the December 2023 dismissal decision would have bypassed the U.S. District Court and gone straight to the Circuit Court. At a hearing on Tuesday, Judge Sean Lane approved the Genesis Global Debtors Global Settlement with former Earn Lending Program partner Gemini Trust Co., the ad hoc group of Genesis lenders, and the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors. The agreement resolves all Gemini-related issues in the Chapter 11 cases and provides for full in-kind recovery to the Genesis lenders. Seven claimants said they intend to file a new lawsuit alleging conspiracy and a pattern of racketeering activity against former Judge David R. Jones, Elizabeth Freeman, and law firms Kirkland Ellis and Jackson Walker, previewing the complaint in an objection to orders in the related Jackson Walker professional fee disgorgement matters. The claimant group suggested the litigation targets manipulated the bankruptcy system by concealing Jones and Freeman's romantic relationship, violating the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. Ardoc Group, Cumulus Media, City Brewing, iCare Partners, SVP Worldwide, Tenneco, Del Monte Foods, Alkagen, Exec Tech, and Foxwoods Resort Casino round out this week's crop of near-term restructurings and refinancings and new advisor mandates. Last week, Ardagh Group announced a financing transaction with Apollo to facilitate repayment of its $700 million of secured notes due April 2025. The transaction, which will give rise to two new senior secured term loan facilities secured by Ardagh's equity stake in Ardagh Metal Packaging, effectively primes existing unsecured notes with regard to the equity stake and allows Apollo to up-tier certain of its unsecured and PIK note holdings, both current and potential future purchases via an exchange into an up to $250 million. Cumulus Media announced a new transaction support agreement for a three-year extension of the maturities of both the 2026 existing term loan and 2026 first lien 6.75% notes to 2029. The notes and term loans would each get a 1.25% pickup in coupon and spread, respectively, compared to the old instruments. REWORK estimates that this will increase annual cash interest expense by approximately $5 million per annum in 2024 and 2025 from prior levels. City Brewing launched a liability management transaction last week that involved $115 million of new money in the form of SOFR plus 625 BIPs first lien first out facility, as well as double dip and intercompany loan features to incentivize participation and minimize holdouts. iCare Partners closed a private debt exchange with holders of a majority of its existing term loans and said it plans to launch a public debt exchange offer to remaining lenders. In addition, the company secured $275 million in new money investment, and lenders agreed to extend maturities. REWORK reports that second lien lenders are working with Deckert as counsel and Perla Weinberg Partners as investment banker in liability and management negotiations with the company. SVP Worldwide closed a transaction last week with 100% lender support to PIK interest payments and shut down amortization payments for some time in exchange for a coupon bump and sponsor Platinum Equity contributing $20 million of new money and subordinating a portion of its loans. The pro-rata deal, the structure of which works around the restrictions of CLO lenders in relation to receiving PIK interest, gives the sewing machine maker more time and liquidity for recovery. Private equity firm Apollo Global Management purchased roughly half of a $1 billion bridge facility underwritten by a syndicate of Wall Street's largest banks to partly finance the firm's 2022 buyout of auto parts supplier Tenneco, while the company itself also bought back $103 million of the same facility during the same period. Tenneco also recently disclosed fourth quarter 2023 earnings to lenders, reporting that credit agreement EBITDA jumped 63% on a year-over-year basis to $371 million. According to an analysis published last week by REWORK, packaged food producer and marketer Del Monte Foods has burned nearly $600 million of free cash flow over the last seven fiscal quarters through January 28th due to deteriorating operating performance and soaring inventory levels. In order to combat dwindling liquidity, management plans inventory reductions and asset sales. Del Monte Foods lenders are getting restricted to conduct due diligence ahead of a potential transaction to boost liquidity. The Foxwoods Resort Casino Special Revenue Obligation bondholders are now working with Centerview Partners as an investment banker as the travel casino faces debt maturities starting next year and weak liquidity. The company is working with Creamer Levin as legal advisor and PJT Partners as an investment banker. Alkagen is working with Centerview Partners as an investment banker, according to sources. The specialty materials producer is gauging interest of new investors to help address debt maturities and boost liquidity. ExactTech is working with Ropes & Gray as counsel, as well as Centerview Partners as an investment banker on a potential restructuring. Top red stories this week included sovereign debt restructuring, exploring the common framework's growing pains and the rise of value recovery instruments. Prepackaged dips getting popularity offered lucrative terms to lenders. China's state-backed developer Vanke cut to junk again. Atos secures 400 million euro emergency funding ahead of restructuring. And now here's Kate Thomas from New York with the week ahead.
Welcome to the week ahead. My name is Kate Thomas, and here are a few highlights from the upcoming week. A longer schedule of hearings can be found under America's Week Ahead on the REORG website. This week is shaping up to be a lighter week given the Passover holiday, and things don't really get underway until Thursday, when Joann Stores will seek confirmation of its prepackaged plan of reorganization. The plan calls for a debt-for-equity swap that would deleverage the company's balance sheets by over $500 million and turn company ownership over to the term loan lenders. The plan also provides for the company's $142 million dip facility to convert into an exit facility. Last week, Joann reported that the plan was unanimously accepted by all voting classes. Then on Friday, Acorda Therapeutics will seek final approval of its $60 million senior secured DIP financing. The facility consists of a $20 million new money multi-draw term loan and a $40 million roll-up of pre-petition noteholders' obligations. Judge David S. Jones raised several concerns with the facility at the first day hearing. And while no objections have been filed yet, the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors has until Tuesday to weigh in on the financing. The Acorda debtors are also seeking approval of bid procedures for a sale of the company. Acorda filed Chapter 11 with a restructuring support agreement that calls for the debtors to test a $185 million stalking horse bid from MERS Pharmaceuticals before winding down. That's it for now. For more on the week ahead, check out America's Week Ahead on the REORG website, and have a great week.
Thank you again for tuning in to the REORG Primary Review and our weekly review. Find all our podcasts on the REORG.com webinars and podcast page, as well as Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Amazon. Take care and see you all next week.